a privilege, actually, I think, today to have Heather Berenger with us. She's going to be talking a little bit about her journey through her relatively short journey. She's still very much a lot of journey ahead of her, but has had an interesting pathway into the profession. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about it. I think it's particularly apropos because, and I don't know if some of the organizers of the professional day are here, aren't they? Yes, of course, over here. But this is very close to the theme, can I say that, and without blowing your cover? To the theme of professional day coming up in the early new year. So it is timely, and we are delighted to welcome Heather here. I won't rehearse her bona fides. I think you've all seen them in the emails that we sent out and in the posters. So with that very inadequate introduction, Heather, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you. I'm hoping we'll still finish at the appointed time because I will not talk that much. I am fairly concise, or try to be fairly concise. So the goal will be to finish early so that there's time for discussion, because I think that's probably what is most interesting. I thought I would try to give you just a little bit of background. I think you've seen the bio, but I will say that I started out in academic libraries. I then went to the vendor community for about 5 years, and now I am back in an academic library. Again, I am based in Kelowna, not Vancouver, so I work at the UBC's Okanagan campus as opposed to the Vancouver campus. And it was kind of a funny trip that got me to being a librarian. I initially wanted to be a teacher. I thought that for sure being a teacher was the way to go. Then I realized that was going to involve children, and I don't really like them. So it seemed that probably that was a poor choice. So I sat down with a friend of mine who I didn't actually know was a librarian at that time, and he started asking me what aspects of teaching I thought I might enjoy, not the children, obviously, and said, you know, I think what you might actually be interested in is librarianship. And it kind of made sense, but only at that moment, because my first job at 16 had been in the public library. I had a shelver tag, was frequently called Chelvé. That's an interesting name, Chelvé. Then ended up working in various libraries at the universities where I did my undergraduate degrees. So I decided that I would go to library school. I started out at University of Toronto Library School, and like many things in my life, it lasted a very short time. And I ended up at Dalhousie Library School, which was pretty wonderful, and I really liked it there. And as I sort of formulated my career path at the library school, I was shaped by my professors and by the professional associations that I was a part of, and I got very heavily involved in. And I decided that I had a dream, and that my dream was to go into the illustrious world of academic librarianship. I was going to start out in the ranks as a reference librarian, because that was the pinnacle, I thought, of success, to be a reference librarian in an academic library. I was then going to be promoted, and I was going to become a manager of a department or some kind of department head position, and this would all happen in fairly short sequence, because I was so good that I was going to make it happen. And then I would be just like my idol, Ernie Ingalls, who did, in fact, look like that about 12 years ago, 13 years ago. Is that right, Ernie? 12 or 13 years ago. I mean, the poster was right on my wall next to New Kids on the Block. Come on. So I figured that I was going to become the head of a large academic research library, and that was going to take, what, 15 years? Something like that? Maybe a little longer because I was a woman. I probably can't say that, but I will. That was not the reality. The reality was that I got that first job as an academic librarian. I was a reference librarian at Carleton University Library. And I was very, very quickly frustrated. And it was through no fault, really, of my colleagues. It was through pretty much no fault of anyone's, except my own, for not thinking about what it was that I wanted and where I wanted to be and how quickly I wanted to be there. But I had a wonderful university librarian who essentially said to me, you know, you're talented, and I understand that you want to manage, but have you looked around recently at all of the tenured librarians in management positions who aren't going to retire for the next 25 years? What do you want me to do for you? And when I started to think about that, I realized she was in a very difficult position. And so what she did do for me was ultimately send me to Northern Exposure, in fact, where I got a little bit of insight into what some of the options were. So I decided that this, in fact, was good. that the fact that I recognized that I wasn't very happy meant something, that the fact that I figured I'd kind of gone down the wrong path, but maybe there was still redemption somewhere along the way, meant that surely there was something I could do. So I'm taking you back to the year 2007, when some of you might not have been here, I'm afraid. I'm starting to feel very old. First iPhone, umbrella. Who doesn't remember Rihanna's umbrella? Those were the days when she wore clothes. And then there were 2 years that had passed at that point since the ADARS report, and I'm sure probably in some of your classes and you've discussed some of the findings of the ADARS report, everybody was talking about how fabulous the report was, and everybody was talking about the fact that wasn't it going to be tragic when we had this shortage in librarianship and there were going to be management positions for everybody who wanted one. And I just kept reading this stuff, that 77% of senior librarians have worked in their organizations for more than 10 years, that 75% of them indicated, I love this, they would consider delaying their retirement. That was fabulous news from my perspective. And that 88% of the librarians were reporting that they stayed at their current workplace because they liked it. And why shouldn't they? Well, I didn't like it very much at all. And that promotional opportunities are hampered primarily because of low staff turnover. Thanks for the information. I'm the staff that want you to leave right now. And nobody was doing it. So, what I pulled out here, and I'm going to read it, even though I would normally not read off a slide because I understand I'm being recorded. So I apologize for my large text block, but I want to be able to have it on the podcast. So this was just a quote that I wanted to pull out. Of course, I can't read it without moving. That lack of turnover is not a concern, except insofar as it has affected upward mobility or promotion opportunities for librarians. Again, something I was pretty concerned about in 2007. Libraries can encourage employee growth by providing challenging assignments and additional professional development throughout their careers. And I will say, to the credit of my university librarian at that time, when she realized how difficult I was finding it, she did make every effort to give me opportunities to work on special projects and to manage those projects, but none of them involved managing people. It all involved managing stuff. If this is not immediately possible, individuals wishing to expand their skill sets and professional competencies can also look to professional and other associations for opportunities to build skill sets while making a professional contribution. Well, let me tell you something about 2007, when I took a look at what the professional associations had to offer. And at that time, I will say that I was in Nova Scotia, so it was a smaller pool of opportunity than perhaps I'd been in a larger place. The regional associations were not really taking off. They were small. There were a lot of people interested in being involved. I was looking to the national organization at that time, so I was looking to CLA. And what did I see there in 2007? And remember, I was young and I was an upstart and I was kind of cranky most of the time and thought I was always right. That it's a bunch of old people there too. When are they going to get out and let somebody new get on some of these committees and chair some of these groups? They weren't. They were just going to have interest groups that essentially did nothing except give me a CV line, and I wasn't going to get to do anything or gain any real skills. So, what did I do? I did what every good academic librarian do. I wrote an article and I trashed everybody that I worked with, which was a really bad move. So if there's one thing I can tell you in terms of career-limiting moves, it's don't write academic articles that trash your colleagues and publish them in the National Association publication, especially when you're talking about how the National Association is full of old people who should leave the association. So it was a pretty bad move at the time, and in retrospect, I would potentially have done it differently. But mostly what I did was complain, and I can't bring myself to read all this texting, so I will paraphrase, was essentially say, maybe we should rotate some of these losers out of these positions so that we can have some of the newer people give it a shot. That went over like a lid at my institution. And I was told that intellectual freedom was very important in the academy, and it was good that I had opinions, and I should probably keep them to myself. And so I decided at that point that this was just not working out. And it wasn't, again, because I had poor colleagues. And it was mostly, I put this on myself because I hadn't really considered what was important to me before I went out there and got a job. I considered what sounded good on the surface. So I bring up the parable, and you hear this parable in business all the time. And it's about the guy who's walking down the street, and he hears his dog whimpering, and it's his neighbor's dog. And he looks over at his neighbor, and he says, "Yo, buddy, why is your dog whimpering like that?" And the guy goes, "Well, he's sitting on a nail." It's like, why doesn't he move off the nail? I guess it doesn't hurt that man. It's like, well, you know what? That's pretty much what I was doing. I was sitting around with this nail digging into me, telling me that I had made a bad choice, telling me that it was the wrong place to be, and I wasn't doing anything except complaining about it. And frankly, that really doesn't get you anywhere, so I decided it was time to move off the nail. And I had gone, as I said, to the Northern Exposure Leadership Institute, and there I had met some sponsors who worked for various corporate organizations. One of them, who now works for EBL, which is an e-book company, but at that time worked for YDP Library Services, spoke to me at that place, listened to my whining about sitting on the nail, and he said, you know, have you ever thought about just getting the heck out of there and coming over to the vendor side and working as a vendor for a while? And the truth was I had never thought about doing something like that because it just never occurred to me that the vendors hired librarians. So I am telling you that the vendor community is the second largest employer of librarians after libraries anywhere. And so there are actually a lot of librarians who work for vendors, and it's really important to keep that in mind. So I ended up not taking his job at that time, but later, after I went back and went on stress leave, decided that maybe it was time to give him a call and find out whether there were any opportunities in the vendor field. And there were. I went to work for a company called YBP Library Services, and I was there for about 5 years in total. So just a little bit about YBP because it's helpful in terms of the background. I really did like academic libraries. I cared about them, and I was interested in still continuing to work with them in some capacity. And so it turned out that YBP, which I had never heard of at that point, to be frank, is the largest vendor of academic monographs to libraries, certainly in North America, not in the world. There are others in the world that they compete with, but in North America, it's the largest vendor. And owned by Baker Taylor, which is, in fact, the world's largest vendor of books and entertainment products to not only libraries, but also to the retail market. So it was a huge institutional or organizational culture to deal with, and a big shift. And one other thing that was really fascinating was that the business model at YBP was not just about selling books. It was also about working with technical services and approval plans, and I don't know how many of you take the collections course, and we'll know all about approval plans. But it was actually a very complex business model, and there was a lot to learn. It was a combination of collections work and technical services work and teaching, because there was a lot of training involved. And so there were a lot of different aspects to that work that I probably hadn't really thought of. So what I thought I would do is maybe provide some of the observations that I made, some of them quickly, some of them it took a little longer, about working for the vendor. And I'm going to compare mostly to working in academic libraries because that's what I know. But I have spoken to some of my colleagues who have been in academic libraries or corporate sector and gone to public libraries as well, just so that I could get a bit of their sense of what might be different. And so a few things that I noticed right away. Number one, working from home in your pajamas is the bomb. My commute went from an hour and a half every day to 5 seconds because I worked in a home office with my cat. So in fact, there's actually one day where my cat fell in the washing machine while I was on a conference call. That was great because they could hear him in the background. I was like, what's going on with your cat? I'm like, oh, he's in the washing machine. It was a good time. So the first thing that I realized was working from home was great, that I had colleagues from all over the world. We were dealing with a lot of time zones in that time period. But I had colleagues in Australia, I had colleagues in the Middle East, colleagues in the United States, colleagues in Asia. So it was fascinating and culturally really interesting to work with all of these different people, work on their schedules. I had so much flexibility in terms of working hours. I could get up and work early in the morning and take the middle of the day off and take a nap and then go back to work in the evening. I was able to choose when I traveled, and I did travel a lot. And we started out at about 50 to 60% of the time on the road and went up to 70 or 80% of the time on the road, so it was a big, big shift. And this is my personal favorite, that while in the academic library, when I walked up to technical services and said, hey, could you show me how to catalog a book? Because I'm really interested. And they looked at me like, well, no, that's not part of your job. You're a reference librarian. You don't need to know how we do this. And I thought, well, but I want to know how I do this. Could you just let me catalog a book? It's not in your job description. Then in the corporate sector, nobody cared. They were like, if you know what you're doing, we will show you how to do more of it. You don't know enough about technical services, we will bring you down to corporate office and we will train you in technical services. If you want to know how to set up a monograph workflow from the time a library brings in a book to the time it ends up on the shelf, we will teach you how to do that. And then we will send you out and have you teach other people how to do that. So from the perspective of the corporate side, if you have the skills they need that are the people piece, the soft skills, some people will call them, they will train you in all of the hardcore stuff that you need to know. And I know way more about all areas of a library than I did when I went into it. Things that it took me longer to realize, and that I would say happened over a period of time, was that, man, things moved a lot faster in the corporate sector than they moved when I worked in an academic library. It was like one day the product didn't exist, the next day somebody read about it on a blog somewhere, and the next day we were trying to put it out before the competitor. So we did a lot of things very, very quickly, and as a somewhat impatient person, and that is a skill I really need to work on for myself, that was exciting. It meant that there was always something new, there was always something in pilot or in beta, and that if you had an idea or heard about something out in the community and brought it back to headquarters, they were very interested in implementing it, and not only that, they wanted you to lead the group that was going to create it. So innovation was a constant, and they were really interested in hearing your ideas as long as they would make money. That was, of course, the downside, which I'll talk about later. Results-focused organizational culture, and the best way that I could think of to put this was that if you do what they hired you to do, basically, you will make a salary. If you work really hard, you will make a salary plus commissions. If you work even harder, you will make even more money. And it's not like it's going to keep coming at you, but you will make more money. And if you perform well, in addition to working hard, you will get promoted. I mean, if there is no job for you, they will create a job for you so that you recognize that you are valued in the corporation and they don't want to lose you. I saw so many people get promoted to vice president without their job ever changing that it was fascinating. And they didn't even get any more money for that, but they at least got the recognition that they brought something valuable to the workplace, and there was very quick promotion. So I started out as a regional manager for Eastern Canada. I covered Ontario to Newfoundland, and I was in that position for about 2.5 years or so, and then I was promoted to sales director for Canada. So I managed the entire country. I had a team that worked for me. I had a budget of about $28 million. It was a pretty high-profile position, and it was very interesting and a lot of fun, and I had only been with the company at that point for 2.5 years. So it was, again, fast-paced, but also very quickly an increased level of responsibility and money, frankly. Something that was troubling, however, was that when I went to the corporate sector, the first thing someone said to me is, "Wow, how come you sold out?" And I thought, you know, I don't really care that much about the money, which is tough to say after I just came off the slide with all the dollar signs. But the reality was that was not what prompted me to move. And frankly, if that is what had prompted me to move, it was none of that guy's business when it comes right down to it. But what I did find was that there was a troubling sense out there among the librarians that I had considered my colleagues 3 days ago, in some cases, that now I was at a lower level of, I deserved less respect, frankly, than they did, because they were true librarians, and I was the sellout who went to corporate. And let me tell you something about the sellouts who are librarians who go to corporate. They change the corporate culture. And if you are a librarian, buying books, let's say, for a library, which is something most libraries have to do, like, you know, print books, e-books, it's kind of important to have access to information in libraries. If you have the opportunity to work with a librarian in that task, would you not prefer to work with a librarian than with someone who has no experience with libraries? Usually the answer is yes, and yet my favorite experience was at a conference. I used to go to the conferences and stand at the booth. You know, you feel like you're at the science fair, you're going around looking at the booth. And I used to stand at the booth, and I had a student come up to me one day, very nice young woman, I mean, really. And we were talking, and I sort of looked at my watch, and I said, "I am really enjoying this conversation, but I have a session that I would like to go to. If you're going that way, that would be great. I'm happy to continue the conversation, or we could plan to meet up later, and I'd like to continue to talk." It wasn't even about business. And her response was, "Oh, they let you go to sessions?" And I sort of was taken aback at that. And then I said, "Well, actually, my company pays for the sessions. So the way that those conferences happen is that the vendors pay for space to allow the organization to sponsor the conference. It's not just the price of registration that is cost recovery. There's a lot of money that comes out of the vendor community back into the library community. So it's really important, in my opinion, to respect that, to respect people's history. And also, this was my favorite thing, was when people suspected I had ulterior motives. When I would say to them, you know, you're doing something really interesting at your library, and I work with 100 libraries. You're doing what you're doing in an innovative way. I think we should think about presenting something at a conference. And their response would be, what's in it for you? Do you want an advertisement for your product? No, I just thought you were innovative, but it turns out you're kind of a jerk. So I guess we're not going to do that anymore, are we? So if you're approached by a vendor to do a presentation, I would take that as a compliment. These are people that are working with a lot of libraries, and they have determined that what you are doing is potentially one of the most innovative things in a region, in the country, internationally. They actually have some insight. So. One of the things, actually, I'm going to go back for one second, because you know what I thought of when I put this part about being treated as another, and I'm going to sound like a real geek if I say, seriously, I don't know if you watch Star Trek, and in fact, Next Generation, so you might, I'm not even sure if you're around Next Generation, but I always remembered that scene, if you do watch it, with Worf, the Klingon, where his father is accused of betraying the Klingons, and so they're standing in a circle, a bunch of really scary looking men. And he's in the middle, and he agrees to accept responsibility for his father's betrayal of the Klingons. Even though they didn't do it, he's really just protecting a couple of really trampy women who are involved in the council. And as soon as he is willing to take the fall, everybody like crosses their arms and goes, "Move!" and turns around and like excommunicates him from being Klingon. And I'll tell you, that is how I felt all the time. It was brutal. And then I told that story to someone once about how I felt, and they came back with, "It's like Worf in the Kidamar Massacre." Oh, okay, I'll use that sometime. So, a few the points that I thought might be useful just to get you thinking, because in case you haven't figured it out, where I'm going to go with this in the end is into like some really hokey, new agey stuff about thinking about your future. So before we get there, just a few things that I would say, and from talking with my public library colleagues, but a few things that I would suggest are things to think about. And to think about in terms of how do you feel about these things, because they will be different in many organizations. And as I talked to lots of people, these were the things that caused people to say, I don't know if I belong here, maybe I want to think about something else. So I tried to divide them up first into like bigger themes and then into more individual themes. And one of the things, decision making. How are decisions made in the organization? Are they made by committee? Because that can be frustrating, or can be wonderful if that's the kind of way that you like to work. They can be very top-down. Some organizations in the corporate sector almost always is very top-down. There's a CEO, they have an agenda, and they are driving that agenda forward. There are lots of libraries that are run like businesses, and so in those cases, sometimes the decision-making is top-down or made by a board. Is it made very collegially? Are people independent, and they make decisions on their own about what they're going to do? How much responsibility do you want for the decisions that you make, and how much are you happy to take direction from above? Those things are really important in organizations. What's the focus of the organization? And that, I thought, would not matter that much to me, whether something was profit-driven versus not-for-profit. It mattered more than I thought, but what I will say is that the organization that is profit-driven, my experience has been that it is also very innovative in many cases, because the way to make money is usually to get out in front and to try something new. And if you've got the money, the resources, then you can take more risks. And if you have, one of the most wonderful things I got to do working in the corporate sector was to decide who we would give our money to. Which library conferences would we sponsor, and for how much? Which awards would we sponsor, and for how much? What kinds of things would we recognize from the library community with a financial contribution? That was really very gratifying for me to be able to give back that way. Are people motivated by making the team succeed, or are they more motivated about making themselves look good? And hey, if you're someone who wants to make yourself stand out, then you probably want to work in an organization where there's an individual focus, and there's nothing wrong with that. the pace of change, we talked enough about that, I don't need to go back. And when I say team diversity, I don't mean, you know, the diversity necessary that people are coming from different countries, which is important and is interesting. But also, one of the things I have noticed is that in academic libraries, for example, in many cases, we have librarians running a lot of areas that they're not necessarily professionally qualified to run. And I say that with respect for what they're doing. But in the corporate sector, we had an HR professional to run HR. We had an accountant to run finance. We didn't have a librarian who knew something about HR to run HR. And I'm not saying it's bad, but I'm saying that if you're somebody who would like to be a librarian who knows something about HR and maybe doesn't want to get a professional designation in HR, you may have a different idea about where you want to go than not. Or if you are, and I have heard people say, particularly from a public library perspective, that they really enjoyed sitting on committees and boards with professionals that have perspectives that come from outside librarianship. They found that really refreshing and interesting, and that they are talking about things they might not otherwise talk about. So then the more personal stuff, it's okay if you want to get rich. I hope you didn't come to library school thinking you would. But it's okay if that's what is really motivating to you. If it's really important to you to make a lot of money, well, you may not necessarily want to go into a position that doesn't pay well. It's just kind of a, you know, an obvious statement. If job security is very important to you, well, I saw a lot of people get fired. As many people as I saw get promoted to vice president, I saw get fired, and they were done at the end of the day. It wasn't like, you know, well, let me give you 2 months to sort out your affairs. It's like, you stink, you're out, give me your computer right now. It was rough. I watched managers fly to another person's city, have them meet them at the airport to take their stuff away, and then say, you don't have a job anymore, you're gone. And it happened. Pension is another one. You know, I had no benefits when I worked because I was an international organization that didn't supply benefits to international workers. I was American. Maternity leave, which was, of course, not an issue to me because we remember the first slide, we're adult children. But it was an issue for some other people because maternity leave for our company was a couple of weeks, and we were able to negotiate that in Canada because of Canadian law, but it wasn't always possible to do, and the pay was not good. Certainly there was no such thing as a top-up from the U.S. company for Canadian maternity leave. Workload, hours, all of those things sound like they don't matter, but I'll tell you, I did not work less than a 70-hour week very often when I was in corporate. I know people that I work with now who come in at 8 o'clock in the morning and leave at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I respect their right to do that. That's what they need to do. But on the other hand, they've made the choice that what's important to them is to do their job while they're at work, and that they have a whole bunch of other stuff they do outside of work, and that's where they would rather spend time. And so they have a good job that they enjoy, that they can come in at 8 and leave at 4 from, and they're very happy to do that. So depending on where you fall in that spectrum, it may make a lot of sense to think about. Measures of success, I say, because again, if you value very much being paid because you worked harder than the guy next to you, then that happens differently in different organizations. And then the whole personal values piece and professional values, which I didn't write on the slide, but I think are really important to think about. Honestly, that's why I left corporate. Not because I didn't like my job, although I was getting pretty tired of traveling 70 or 80% of the time, but it was mostly because I was ready to get back into feeling like I was accepted as a professional, and that was a huge reason that I came out of libraries. So this is like the hokey pocus pocus stuff, but I couldn't resist because I felt like, if nothing else, I could at least say, here's 4 things I think you should do. And it would seem like I'd thought about this more than I really did. So the first thing that I would say, and again, it sounds so like, I feel like a new age nut by saying it. Commit to discovering the dream. Right, okay, so what does that mean in real words? What are you going to do today? You are in library school. Let me tell you, there's a lot of free stuff you can get while you're still a student, or cheap stuff you can get while you're still a student that you cannot get anymore when you are not a student. You have access to a lot of professionals who are willing to match you up with lots of other people. You have access to a lot of assessment tools. You know, you can do the Myers-Briggs or the StrengthFinder. There's lots of other questions out there or assessment tools out there that you can get at a very low cost to help you learn about yourself while you're still a student that will cost you a fortune when you get out into the corporate workspace. So now is the time to start pestering the people who have money in the school to ask them to help you to get some of these things, because they are the ones that can help you. And I would suggest take an inventory. What are your values? What are the skills that you have to bring to the table? Are you naturally extroverted and want to always be, you know, jumping around and crazy? Or would you prefer to be doing something else? What are the areas you're going to have to work on? But knowing you is the first step to, I guess, you know, discovering the dream, whatever. That is a silly way to put it. But it is really important to think of what you're going to do right now to figure out what it is about yourself that you don't know. And then you have to take that dream and give it some kind of definition. So do you actually have a vision of what that looks like? I mean, step back, and I did it, and my feeling about it has changed, but step back and say, where do I want to be in 5 years? Where do I want to be in 10 years? Where do I want to be in 20 years? And how am I going to get there? So that's kind of important. This is my personal problem is the shoulds. That's what caused me the most difficulty in library school. I should want to be an academic. I don't know why. I don't know why I feel that way. Probably because I respect other people who are academics. But I should want to do that. I should want to serve my community. I mean, there were lots of different things. I shouldn't be driven by profit. I should be this, I should be that. Well, there really aren't any shoulds when it comes right down to it. You don't have anybody here telling you what you have to do. You can change paths along the way. So none of that matters. It's really just, what do you want? Like, what is important to you? And then the really important piece, get the capital. So that's not necessarily money. It's resources of some kind. And are you doing the things you need to do to get where you want to be? It sounds pretty obvious, but it's actually not. So, for example, when you graduate, many of you will be in debt, will be really, really eager to get a job, and you're like, oh, there was that lady who talked about thinking about my dream. My dream is to get a job, lady. I just want to get a job. I don't care what it looks like. Fair enough. Honestly, that means you need to make money to pay your bills. That's the real world. But if you have that job that you know in your mind is not the forever job, then where is it that you want to be? And is that job, it's not the forever job, getting you the skills that you need to get to where it is you want to be? And if it's not, how are you going to get them? So if you need leadership experience, where are you going to get it? Maybe in the professional associations. Maybe you're going to get involved in community government. Maybe you would get involved in some other kind of organization where you can take on a leadership role. But in the end, you've got to find some way to fill the gap. And job postings, for me, were the best way. Look at the job postings that come out for these senior manager positions, even if that's 20 years down the road, and see what they're looking for. Because some of the skills they're looking for, it's going to take you 20 years to get them. And so how are you going to get yourself on a path now, starting right now? What's that thing about the 20,000 hours practice makes you an expert? So if you start now, it's only an hour a day. If you wait 10 years, all of a sudden, it's going to take you a whole lot more time. And write an elevator speech. Sounds jokey, but what I'm trying to say there is be ready to sell the skills that you got in these non-traditional ways. Funny story, when I did my interview for this job, one of the questions was, have you ever managed a budget? And I was so excited to get that question because I was able to say, well, actually, last year I managed a $26 million budget with areas across it. And it looked at me very seriously and said, but have you ever managed a subject budget? I thought, I just told you I managed a $28 million national budget, and you want to know if I know how to buy an engineering book? That's essentially what the question was. So I said, yes, when I worked at Carleton University, I was the selector for history. Oh, excellent. I'm just like, come on. You know, really, we've got our priorities a little messed up here. But fair enough. So be ready to sell the skill you got and find a way to appeal back to the people that you're going to have to sell it to. Some of them will not be ready to hear it. And this is the hard one. So you make a plan, and then you actually follow through. So my plan was to leave academic libraries when I realized I had a problem, to go into the corporate sector for 5 years. That was in my mind what I was going to do. I was going to get management experience, and then I was going to go back to academic libraries again. That was my plan. I got derailed, frankly. I got very comfortable. I liked corporate. I was not feeling the nail, necessarily. I was thinking, you know, maybe I should ride this out for a few more years, because things are going okay. And I was seeing job postings go by that made sense if I wanted to go back to an academic library, but I was sort of like, well, but things are good. Things are cozy. And I actually did have my plan written down, highly important. I have a Moleskin book, and it's all scribbled out because I keep reevaluating it. And every so often I go back. And if I were to look at that time when I was getting comfortable, you know, I hadn't revisited the plan. I hadn't been rereading it. You know what I did? I went to Northern Exposure again as a sponsor this time. And sat down with a smart person, and that person said to me, "What are you doing? You are off the plan." And it's somebody that I had told about the plan. Tell someone you trust. Get them to hold you accountable. And if you want to say, you know what, I've changed the plan, that's fine. But it's better to change the plan consciously and not to just change it because you haven't looked at it or thought about it in a long time. And after the conversation with the person who was keeping me accountable, I ended up in this job. So I decided to follow through with the plan because there were a lot of reasons I had made it. I'm sure you've heard the SMART goals thing about making your goals specific, measurable, attainable. Is this ringing bells with people? So I'm going to repeat it. I like the SMARTer goals, with the evaluate and the reevaluate at the end, because I think one of the things about these plans is that it's really important to write them down, read them often, think about whether they are still in line with where you want to go, and then continue to move forward on the follow-up. I want to stop talking because I feel like I've done a lot of it, and because it's a little hokey. Encourage you to please, please, please contact me. I did bring some business cards because I know Ken Haycock was here like a month ago, but I don't have enough, I'm sure, for everybody in the room. So there are other ways that you could actually get in touch with me if you wanted to take the conversation further. I would be happy to hold you accountable for pretty much anything. I'm very good at that, my staff. And I would be certainly interested in taking questions or turning this into something that's more interactive. Yeah.
You were mentioning of sort of flexibility of hours in a corporate environment. When you think of this in the news, there's, you know, sort of announcement that the trends in general in our society is moving towards sort of freelance work and sort of from at home. Do you find that is also growing in vendor community for libraries and books as well? Like,
oh,
this kind of freelancing?
Absolutely. I would say I would consider it less freelancing and more flexible working hours. Because I think a lot of those companies are still, they're contracting out to some extent, but I think in many cases they're not exactly. I mean, they're considering their remote workforce, you could say freelancers, but they're on the regular payroll. And it is secure in that I was always on the regular payroll. But from their perspective, it is cheaper. It is much, much cheaper for people to work from home and not be coming into an office. They don't have to supply space for them in the office. What they don't think about, and another reason, honestly, that I came out of vendor land, that gets lonely after a while. Working from home with just your cat in a washing machine is not like all that much fun when it comes right down to it after a while. You start to miss people, and I really started to miss bouncing ideas off people easily. I was a lot on the phone, which was okay, but I don't think it's the same. And so that was another difficulty, but I think it's moving more in terms of that. And I hear people now in other sectors saying they want to work from home. Now, different reasons, I suspect, but there's just, I think, more of a push to decentralize in general where possible.
And does the company provide sort of conference and other opportunities for those intersections of ideas and people? Or?
I would say, well, I went to every conference, and as the director in my territory, I could choose to go to every conference. So it was that was a big perk. I liked that because I love conferences, so it's fantastic. But I would say that the company, and that's a challenge sometimes in the vendor community, the companies have a lot of librarians on the front line, fewer librarians at the senior management levels. And I don't think that's necessarily a function of the company. I think it's a function of us. I think that many of us as librarians don't want to be removed from the people we serve and start just working with spreadsheets all day long. I think that is actually the case, and it's not that they're seeing us as unqualified. So, because I didn't see a lot of librarians apply for those senior management positions. They were just too far removed from the customer base. But I think that a lot of that senior management, not being a librarian, doesn't necessarily recognize always the value in sending their folks to conferences just to send them to conferences. If they're standing at a booth, that's a good investment. But to just go as a librarian to further your professional education, less so, I would say. Sorry, thank you.
Would you recommend somebody to walk to job since you have an option to work from home?
Would I recommend it as an option? It depends a lot on your personality. If you're very independent, yes, it's great. If you don't think you'll miss people, it's great. If you have a cat, apparently it's dangerous. I think it's a good experience to have in your pocket. Because one of the things that did come up frequently when I was asked about, you know, various things, it does give you the opportunity to say, I can work independently. Nobody can tell you you can't work independently if you can make, you know, $1 million from home. It sounds like one of those emails that you get in your spam folder, really. But it's, so I would say it was a good experience for me. I don't regret that I did it. It's hard long term.
No, I'm saying 2 jobs, one regular job.
Oh! Well, good luck. I mean, that's pretty awesome if you can get it. Don't answer those emails that are in your spam folder. But you know what? If you could do that, or there are certainly workplaces where you go into the office some days of the week and not others. You know, that's an option. If you can get a job like that, I totally support you in the effort. Or to 2 part-time jobs that equal a job that let you do that. Of course, part-time work, right, the benefits, again, you fall into that trap of, yes, you've got variety, but you're also sometimes a little bit shafted out of benefits. So,
is there much opportunity in the vendor community that doesn't require that much travel? So, I mean, like 50% plus travel is really unappealing, but there's other aspects of that side of library work that everybody interested.
Yes, everybody asks me that. I would say yes. I would say they are more, so if you think about the way libraries are often structured with public services and technical services, and I'm just going to use that as an example, I would say that if you are comfortable to work more on the technical services side, so metadata creation, cataloging, honestly, we have people that cataloged from home, if you're willing to do more, I don't like to say back room because it's not fair, it's incredibly important, but more of that kind of work as opposed to going out and visiting the customers, because the issue is the customers are not coming to you. You have to go to them. And so if you want to be face-to-face with your customer base, you pretty much have to be willing to travel. And 50% is not uncommon. That's now, once you start moving up in the organization, there is an expectation of more travel. Because if something goes tragically wrong, you need to be on a plane right away and out the door. So I would say that yes, if you're comfortable to think about a different kind of opportunity. So a lot of the vendors have large cataloging warehouses, for example, where people go in and work, in fact, in office environments, or catalog from home, work from home. We used to have them. Sorry, you have a question?
Yeah, so with Yankee, I'm a peddler. How is it split up in terms of, so you work for the academic side, was it still on public, academic, and public, and how are the different cultures of those different streams within the company itself?
Oh. I didn't talk about that. Well, what happened was that YBP, which did used to stand for Yankee Book Peddler, I will say, and that for many reasons was shortened to YBP when they became an international company. But they were actually always an academic book vendor, and Baker & Taylor wanted to get into the academic market, and in true Baker & Taylor fashion, instead of starting an academic division, they bought one. So they looked outside the company, looked for a profitable company that they could acquire, and they bought YBP. So I would say there was some tension, but that had a lot more to do not with the public versus academic, with the fact that those who were on the academic side had been bought by another corporate culture, and that made it a little bit difficult. So the tensions that were there, I would say, weren't because of that. But Baker & Taylor continued to manage the public side and the retail side, and YBP continued to manage the academic side. And that's how they proceeded. And they continued to buy more companies. They're still owning companies now. Sorry, there's something.
Yeah, must say, yes, actually the job that you had in corporate culture sounds really, really appealing, especially with travel and everything. So what really was like your title, and what were some of your tasks that you had to do?
What was my main job is the question. Well, my main job was to sell books. When it comes right down to it, that was my main job. Selling books to libraries is not a hard sell. It's pretty easy. So the sideline or the part of the work that I did was to write approval plans. So if you, are people familiar with what an approval plan does? Not really. Okay, so basically, in large academic libraries, selectors, there are usually selectors, and in the current model, it's often that there are selectors associated with various subject areas. Those selectors do not select each individual book, normally, because that would take forever. So in order to facilitate their workload, they bring in somebody from the outside to sit down with each individual selector and have the selector say things like, well, any book that's in the humanities, that's about X, that's by Oxford University Press, we're going to want it. And we try to find ways to make the right books come automatically. And in the old days, you could send them back. We sent the books to the libraries, they looked through them, and then they would pick the ones they wanted to keep and send the other ones back. I would say that is changing, mostly because a lot of the books now come already cataloged with spine labels and everything else, and that's all outsourced to a vendor company. So you could still in theory do it, but it's also very expensive now to mail books back, especially internationally. So most libraries try to keep those plans very refined. My job initially was to write those plans. So I used to have meetings with all the different selectors, build the plans, come up with technical services workflows. So I would come up with ways to get the books arriving, process with the right spine labels, with the right cataloging, with MARC records that they could load into their catalog. We had a lot of different setups for that. You could pick out packages and you would create packages for it. So that was kind of the core of the job that I did. Some of the other vendors sell subscriptions. So serials vendors, for example, that like EBSCO, that would sell subscriptions to databases, or that sell the database products themselves, the abstracts and indexes. I mean, there's so many different kinds of vendors out there, but that's what we did. That's what YPP did. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, and maybe more like, are there people in this field that are more like specialized, like in one subject area, as opposed to, what are you doing more general?
I did general. I did everything. I know the LC, man, just call it out. I can tell you what LC class it falls into at this point. I got to know the LC classes so well over the course of the years that I was at YPP. It was crazy. So we didn't have specialists in different areas, although there are vendors that specialize in, say, medical books, like Logan, which is a Canadian medical book vendor. But I did all of the areas, which set me up well when I was going back in, you know. From one of my interview questions, are there any subject area you wouldn't be comfortable with? Nope. Pretty good with all of them at this point.
So my question sort of jumps from what both Laurel and Kristen said, is that I would have no problem with 70% of my time being on a plane, but I'm also interested in back-end stuff, like metadata and cataloging. However, my concern would be I have zero sales experience.
I had zero sales experience. Somebody came, I went for the interview. They wanted a librarian. Somebody got the idea from wherever that I was loud-mouthed and gregarious. It's crazy. And that I would be able to turn that into sales. You know, they thought that there would be a capacity for me to build relationships with customers, that I would be able to gain their respect. I guess the people who hadn't read the article, that's pretty much who I was going to get. But honestly, they were not that interested. They sort of felt that it was, again, the soft skills they couldn't train on. Teaching someone how to sell. I mean, again, selling a library books. Like, you know, it really wasn't that hard. And many of the libraries, they needed books. The question was just, where were they going to get them at the best price? And who did they like? When the salespeople came, who did they like having lunch with? Who did they like having dinner with? Who treated them nicely? Who knew about their kids? Who cared to follow up with them later on about all the different stuff they talked about? That's what they were interested in, mostly. Because, you know, as going to become librarians, you think, well, who are the people I would want to work with? The responsive people who are pleasant to spend time with and who treat me with respect. That's kind of what it boiled down to. So I would say that's not a non-impediment from my perspective or from YBP's perspective. I will say there are other vendors who put much more stock in that, who will want sales experience. Those are probably not the places to start, they do tend to pay better. I didn't just say that. I think I signed a way that you could put that on the internet, but anyway. They do sometimes tend to pay better because to get professional salespeople, you often need to pay them better than librarians. Sad but true, they have higher expectations in terms of salary, whereas librarians have higher expectations in terms of quality of treatment, I would say. So my, because YDP was more heavily focused on librarians, my base salary was better, and my commissions, it was a lower percentage, whereas in a lot of the other vendor areas, the base salaries, that's not necessarily so good, but the commissions can get take you much higher, and that's what salespeople are used to.
I think we're just about running out of time. I just wanted to thank you on behalf of the speakers committee and behalf of all the students here and faculty and staff. Thank you so much for coming out.
Cool. Thank you.